Welcome to the Anthony and Sabga Caribbean Awards for Excellence podcast, the sound of Caribbean excellence. Here, we feature events, conversations, and interviews with our laureates in science, art, entrepreneurship, and civic activism from around the Caribbean. You may find us online at www.ansacaribbeanawards.com or on Facebook, or visit our YouTube channel, ANSCAFE, ANSCAFE. In this cast, Franca Philip interviews two of our arts laureates who have made the steel pan their life's work. Both interviews were conducted at the Cari Festa held in Port of Spain from August 17th to 24th, 2019. We present an edited version which combines both interviews into one. The first interview is with Professor Liam Teague of Trinidad and Tobago, a panist who is one of the most famous musicians in the world. He is professor of music and steel band studies at Northern Illinois University in the U.S.
Tell me, what is the reception to pan? Okay, you have a program at NIU, but what is the general reception to pan, and how has it changed in the years since you've been living in the U.S.?
Well, generally, people are mystified by the instrument. They can't believe the sound that's coming out of what essentially looks like a garbage can to many people. Obviously, that's not exclusive to the NIU steel band. And so for many people, when they see it, when they hear it, they think about it simply as an instrument. They don't think about any sort of stereotypical sound. But at the same time, it's still an uphill battle, because for many people who are not from the Caribbean, there is a certain stigma attached to the instrument, which is sometimes, people believe that it's more of a novelty. And so what we try to do at NIU is to obviously pay homage to Trinidad and Tobago, of course, and highlight the profundity of the instrument by playing in different styles.
You are leading a generation of new faces in pan. Dr. Gormandy, Sion Gomez, Akua Leith, for example, who is the head of the National Steel Orchestra in Trinidad. How do you all see your mission in pan in Trinidad and Tobago and around the world?
Well, I don't necessarily want to speak for them, but based on what I've been seeing over the past few years, now that they're back in Trinidad, I think that they're taking a more holistic view to the instrument and also to the future of the instrument, because it's not just about themselves, but they are looking at current and future generations and thinking about this in a progressive way. They're becoming more and more business savvy, and just taking a holistic view of things. It's not just enough to be able to have fantastic technique on the instrument, but be able to sight read, be able to understand contracts, etc., And so I'm very, very proud of the work that they're doing.
Liam, do you see the way that pan is set up now in Trinidad and Tobago as a deterrent to its progress?
Well, I'm hesitant to respond to that question in that I'm hardly ever in Trinidad, and I don't always have my finger on the pulse of what's going on there. So a lot of what I understand is based on what I read, or my periodic visits to Trinidad during Panorama. But I see a lot of progress happening with the instrument. And unfortunately, much of the positive side of things doesn't necessarily make front pages of newspapers.
So, for example, the fact that Panorama is what seems to define a lot of the steel band fraternity. Most people think of steel band in terms of Panorama. What would you do if you were in Trinidad and you had a chance to shake things up a bit?
I think we still have to bear in mind that it's such a young instrument, and part of the reason that this instrument has progressed so quickly is because of competition being in our DNA and that whole idea of one-upsmanship, which started with the pioneers. So that's something that'll take a long time to sort of die away with. In a sense, it can be healthy, but when I think Panorama becomes the be-all and end-all, I don't necessarily think that's a good thing. So again, in terms of the positive side of things, what the folks at UWE and UTT are doing, they're really highlighting the various possibilities of the instrument, not just as it applies to Panorama.
So you benefited from your Anthony Sabga Award, and you were able to commission composers, you were able to make collaborations with different musicians. What do you think needs to be done? Because you're one person, but what do you think needs to be done generally in Trinidad and in other places to encourage the commissioning of new music and actually to promote the performance of that new music in places other than at NIU or in concert halls, places where that they're more accessible?
Well, the first thing I think with respect to Trinidad and Tobago that needs to be done is to help people to fall in love with the instrument. Because a lot of times we pay lip service to the instrument. And even within the steel pan fraternity, I think we shoot ourselves in our own feet. You know, because even steel pan players, they don't necessarily support steel pan related concerts, etc. If it's not their particular band. And so we need to really become a fraternity where we support each other, purchase the accessories, purchase CDs, attend concerts, and then we can really have careers in this instrument, you know, that are sustainable. And we need to get to the point where steel pan musicians can have agents that go to bat for them and secure performances with the top orchestras and jazz combos, you name it, in the world, you know.
You think the world is ready and is accepting? Is it that people want good musicians and it doesn't matter what instrument they're playing, and that's why proficient panmen like yourself will always progress?
Well, I just think that what we have in this instrument is magnificent, you know, and whenever I step on a stage, and not just myself, but obviously, you know, I can attest to my career, you know, if I step on stage with a symphony orchestra, at first they look at me skeptically, you know, and they're thinking, what is this guy doing with this, you know, shiny garbage can? But as soon as I start to play and we play music that's profound, it's not a novelty, they realize this is the real deal and their jaws drop. But the thing about it is it needs to happen more consistently. You know, I'm doing my best. There are many other steel pan musicians that are doing their best for the instrument, but it needs to happen more consistently.
Liam, who would you point to as some of the up-and-coming hot shots? They don't have to be Trinidadian. They just have to be musicians who are excelling at pan and have a chance to really put the instrument on the map.
As the Americans say, I'll have to plead the fifth on that, and I'll have to quote David Rudder here. You know, David Rudder, in his song Dedication, he said to name a few but make the others feel small.
Yes.
So I'm a bit hesitant to mention any individuals. There are many, many up-and-coming steel pan musicians that are doing great things. My fear is that there are just not enough opportunities for them. You know, they have the necessary skill set, but what do they do with that talent they possess?
And as far as your career is concerned, you are now fully in academia?
Well, yes. Unfortunately, because I'm not really invited that much to perform in Trinidad, many people see the academic side of myself and they think Professor Teague, mm-hmm. You know, but they don't realize that I started in the University of the Panyard.
Of course, and we remember your CDs and remember your performances at various platforms in Trinidad and Tobago. And most people now probably think, okay, he's now gone off to NIU and he's the head of steel band studies there. So what is he producing that we can probably look up on Amazon and buy? What's he doing?
Well, you know, again, be it my performances with symphony orchestras, jazz combos, I haven't done a CD probably in the past 5 years. I intend on changing that probably next year or in 2 years. I'm going to compose more material. But again, I'm just trying to take a holistic view of things and taking the instrument into different musical spheres, not just performing with steel bands. And pretty soon you should be hearing a lot more of what's to come.
What's coming up next for you, Liam, in terms of performances?
Well, the semester actually starts next week. So between the performances with the NIU Steel Band, my own solo performances, be it with, I have a duo called Pangelic, which is a steel pan and harp with Professor Faye Seaman. So we play in a variety of styles, even calypso music, steel pan and harp. Again, some stuff with university steel bands. I'd have to check my schedule because I'm drawing a blank right now, but it's all a balancing act, as well as trying to be a good husband and a father of two.
Well, Liam, you know, I couldn't have this interview with you without asking you about your beloved Silver Stars. What next for you and Silver Stars?
When I create music for that wonderful ensemble, obviously, I hope that we'll get the desired results. But at the end of the day, I just do what I truly believe in. And I hope that the players and management are happy with it. And the audience, you know, and then the art, it's relative, you know, it's subjective. So while we may not have placed as high as we wanted, I think people enjoyed it, and that's all I can ask for. So we continue to be innovative, and as the late Edwin Pouchet said, it's not just about the music, but also about the spectacle. People can elect to stay home and listen to Panorama, but they don't. So we try to give them a complete show.
And so you're back next year?
It looks that way. It looks that way.
Well, Liam, just tell me, what would you have to say to your fans in Trinidad and Tobago?
Well, I love the people of Trinidad and Tobago, and I really, really wish that I could be more active there, whether it's as a performer or an educator, you know. But barring that, I'll continue to do what I can for the development of music and for young people, you know, in Trinidad and Tobago. So thank you all so much for your support.
We appreciate what you've done. We appreciate what you're doing out there. And I hope you continue to inspire and to push the instrument as far as you can.
The second interviewee is Dr. Kim Johnson, a historian and filmmaker who has made documenting the history of the steel pan his life's work.
So, Kim, you won the award in 2011. How did it benefit you when you won it?
Well, first of all, financially, it's a very generous award. It's a very prestigious award, and in a sense, gives the research you're doing a kind of greater credibility. That's the main way I've benefited, because apart from the fact that it gives me a kind of financial stability, which, you know, as an artist, I never had. Frankly, you and I have been journalists, and you know that journalists are kind of hand-to-mouth people. And the award allowed me a kind of intellectual independence and a kind of comfort to do things I would not have been able to do. So, for example, I was able to kind of go out on a limb in filmmaking and things like that because the award gave me a kind of security. So I would say that's the benefit. It's the benefit of financial comfort for a while.
And Kim, that research that you're talking about has led to some films like Pan, you know, the movie that went all over the world. It also did it go to Discovery Channel or one of those cable channels as well?
It was on PBS in the U.S.
And I think that movie showed the history of the pan in such an innovative way. And it really, really got a fantastic response. What did you follow on with from that?
After that, I made one on the growth of pan in Nigeria. So I filmed that in Lagos, which was, again, a wonderful experience because, you know, as a filmmaker, to actually work in Nollywood was a great experience. And, of course, to go to Africa, as someone who has at least part of my heritage is African, it's a wonderful experience I would recommend to anyone. And you see, working on Pan was responsible for everything I've done since. I mean, all the films I've made, like at the Carnival Institute, which I've done very well. I mean, recently, one of the films I made on Moko Jambi was acquired by a network in New Zealand. So it shows that our film can be internationally marketable by people who have, you know, no link to Trinidad and Tobago, just on the quality.
And Kim, you said it, you mentioned what I was going to ask you about, that you are the director of the Carnival Institute, a very, very important part of our museum curation set up in Trinidad and Tobago. And you said you have been able to make films there because of the access you have now to Carnival. You have a team of young people working with you who are going out and making films about Carnival and other cultural areas. Tell me how you think we could do more than what you're doing now, because clearly you have a small team, you have a limited budget. What else do we need to do to enhance what the Carnival Institute is doing?
Well, there are several things there. I mean, first of all, a few years ago, I was invited by the Minister of Culture to design a museum. And I did so with the assistance of several people who, you know, in their various fields are experts, like, say, Martin Raymond in audio engineering and so on. But when I presented it to the government, they thought, you know, the cost was too high. It wasn't much. It was a few million dollars.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's really quite necessary. So that's, I mean, that's the high end of what we could do. I mean, we work on a shoestring budget, and we, even though we manage to make pretty high quality films, we do it with all kind of equipment, you know, little GoPro here, and sometimes I film things with my phone, and really kind of inadequate stuff. And we borrow and we beg, you know, some friends of mine who have cameras, we, you know, I would ask them, come along and film with me, and things like that. So the first thing I would like us to do is to be able to do it on a more professional basis.
And that's an appeal to whoever, government or private sector, to make
yes,
the carnival,
yes.
make the investment in the Carnival Institute.
Yeah, I mean, for example, okay, we're filming things, and just a tiny, tiny fraction gets put out there with the documentaries and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But what we are doing is we are archiving vast amounts of information, digital information. So what we do is we have piles of hard drives.
Right.
And then we have another pile at my home as an offsite backup, you know, in case there's any fire or anything. But that is not a very efficient way of storing it. You know, hard drives can just spontaneously crash. And if you have several hard drives, that means you can't catalog all of these things. You know, if you filmed something on, say, Mokujambi 4 years ago, and you filmed something this year, what you have this year would be on a different hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have a single folder with all of the Mokujambi things. So there's a lot of inefficiencies. So we should really need some kind of server and more high-end IT equipment, which unfortunately is going to be expensive because of the volume we're dealing with.
Yes.
You know, right now we have about 30 terabytes of material, and I now have discussions with Mawong Sang of the archive, where they have offered to help digitize some things we have, you know, old cassettes and old vinyl.
Mm-hmm. All the things that could easily be lost because the ways of converting these things are dying.
Yes.
But Kim, sorry, go ahead.
So, I mean, we struggle along, trying our best, you know, kind of holding up Kaipeter against the flood.
Mm-hmm. But Kim, what I wanted to ask you, something like Carry Festa, for example, which has blossomed into this really, really popular thing that people want to see and people want to be a part of. Do you think that when people can find a greater appreciation of the same issues that you're talking about, seeing other cultures, wanting to record stuff, you think that that could be an initiative or that could help push what you're asking for? Do you think there's a connection between hosting
and... Well, I think it's necessarily so. I mean, for about 2 or 3 years, I've been trying to get a proposal to CARICOM to establish a network. I mean, I have personal connections with, for example, the Folk Institute of St. Lucia. I know the person in charge of Spice Mask in Grenada. And if we could get money to go there, we want to set up a similar Carnival Institute. I have connections with the Institute of Jamaica and with the Casa del Caribe in Cuba. And I would like to build a network of, you know, similar institutes that do research and education of the Caribbean. I mean, of course, being Trinidadian, I would like Trinidad to be the hub.
Yes.
But either way, I think it's vitally important that we create such a regional network, not just for doing research, but for marketing and to confronting the world as a regional single unity.
And you know, that's interesting because a lot of the people who came on to this festival radio platform have been speaking about networks. So, for example, we spoke to film festival director Nika Luke, and she later also said that something like a regional directory of filmmakers or regional directory of skills.
Well, that's a directory.
Yeah.
I mean, that's relatively easy to do, but
yeah. But I'm just in networking now.
Yeah. Well, when we launched Pan, the film, we launched it at a French documentary film festival called Sunnyside of the Dock. Mm-hmm. And that was not a festival like the Titi Film Festival where people look at a lot of films. That was a festival where people buy and sell films. You know, so nobody wasn't watching no screen. People were there with their laptops and they were trading and trying to get film sold to other countries and networks and so on. And Jean-Michel and I, we were like, you know, with one DVD, we were like vagrants. You know, a country, say Poland or South Africa, so they would have a booth.
Yes.
And they would have, yes, their directory of actors and directors and cinematographers and locations. But they would have, you know, 20 films and 10 TV series and things wow. to sell.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're walking around with one DVD, you know, you're like those people who will unwrap a piece of toilet paper and try to sell you a watch. That's what we were like. And so I spoke to the organizers and I said, look, if we came by you as a region, would you give us a booth? And they said, we'd love to.
Wow.
So, I mean, I'm Trinidad. We could probably provide two or three good films. Jamaica, you know, four or five. The Dominican Republic, eight or nine. Cuba, 10. We could, as a region, we could represent very powerfully our point of view, our film, and perhaps generate and assist young filmmakers ways of marketing their films. So I don't think there's any other way forward.
Yeah.
Because Trinidad is too small. The market is too small to make filmmaking financially viable proposition.
And so therefore the strength in numbers is what you're talking about.
It's the only way forward.
Yeah. Well, Kim, I mean, we there's so much we could talk to you about, but we're running out of time. But I just wanted you to tell me, what next for you? What are you working on?
Oh, gosh, I'm working on several things, eh?
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on a script that is being considered for foreign production on Debbie Jacob and the Boys in YTC.
Oh, fantastic. That's the journalist Debbie Jacob who runs that literacy yes. program in the jails. Yes.
Right. But it's the other side of the coin. In other words, Debbie's book, Wishing for Wings, is about Debbie's experience.
Mm-hmm.
The film is the boys' experience.
Oh, okay. Very good.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's one of the big projects I'm working on. And of course, I have my work with the Carnival Institute, where we try to do one feature length every year or two, and then several shorts.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, you know, many short little 5-minute pieces. Like there's one, a series called Carnival Quickies, which explain, you know, interesting facts about Carnival in a very
engaging,
easy to look at way.
Yes.
You know, engaging. Well, we've been trying our hand at animation. We have a series called Kaiso Quickies. Kaiso Chats, which is in the interviews we've done with Calypsonians. Again, telling anecdotes about their professional life.
Yeah.
So we have all of those various series. And, you know, further down the pipeline, there are some things we will have to do, but we'll have to get sponsorship. So the Carnival Institute has to have a proper documentary on Carnival, its origins, and how it came to be the number one international festival. You know, our Carnival is not the biggest in the world, but it's the one that has the most progeny.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think Keatness and them have counted about 40 carnivals that were started by the Trinidad Carnival. And these would have to include Notting Hill,
yes,
Labor Day in Brooklyn, Caribana, and those are the largest street festivals in those countries.
Yes, yes. All right, Kim. Well, it was fantastic talking to you, as usual. And I really hope to hear more about what's happening at the Carnival Institute and more about your film that we hope will be shown internationally and show a positive side of life in Trinidad. Thank you for speaking with us, Kim.
Pleasure is mine.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for joining us. You may find us online at www.ansacaribbeanawards.com, on Facebook, or on YouTube.